for a meeting on Tuesday, at which, to his chagrin, he would feel obliged to wear a suit. He broke out the shirt early Monday morning and reported punctually to the monumental six-story Doric-columned graystone Herbert C. Hoover office building, a structure that has stood on the entire 1400 block of Constitution Avenue for more than 70 years as a massive symbol of prosperity, the granite fortress of American commerce. Shortly after 8 o'clock, Rodney was standing before a room full of commerce officials. Among those in attendance that morning was an attorney with a background in Internet issues who had been working on a 60-day review of cyber issues for the newly inaugurated President Barack Obama. As Rodney began to launch into his presentation, firing up his PowerPoint display, one of the officials asked, "Didn't we already have this briefing?" There was momentary confusion and alarm. One does not convene the grandly important and extremely busy poobahs of American prosperity for a briefing they have already received. Rodney's friend had a few bad moments here. It seems that someone from the U.S. Computer Emergency Readiness Team, U.S. CERT, the agency charged with protecting federal computer systems, had met with most of this very Commerce Department crowd in the previous week for an urgent briefing. Material from that session was hastily found and presented to Rodney, who saw, to his surprise, that last week's urgent briefing had concerned Configure B, which had appeared more than 2 months earlier. Apparently, the alarm sounded by Rick Wesson in early January in his Note from the Trenches was still getting the classic bureaucratic slow-mo treatment, inching its way from department to department. It confirmed Rodney's already poor opinion of U.S. CERT. Well, folks, if that briefing last week scared you, and it should have, you might want to tighten your seatbelts. Rodney went ahead with his presentation about Configure C, pointing out the seemingly insurmountable challenge the cabal now faced in protecting the Internet. When he had finished, the room was quiet. One of the officials asked Rodney if he was free to give the same presentation at 1 o'clock that afternoon at FBI headquarters, where U.S. CERT held a meeting about current high-level threats every other Monday. Rodney said he would have to move some things around on his schedule, but that this sounded like the kind of occasion that warranted it. The same official then left the room and returned moments later to confirm that he had spoken to one of the deputy U.S. CERT directors and obtained permission for Rodney to attend. The meeting in question was a classified briefing about cyber threats run by U.S. CERT Director Michelle Kwan. Usually, the computer security chiefs of various vital government agencies attended. Rodney left the Hoover building and went back to his New Star offices. He knew Kwan. He had met her on several occasions. He did not want to ambush her or show her up, given the fact that her agency seemed so far behind on the threat. He had tried to contact her several times in the previous months, but had been ignored. Still, as a courtesy, he tried again. He sent her an email saying that he would be seeing her at the briefing in a few hours, and quickly summarized his presentation. He closed by offering to talk to her beforehand if she wished. Kwan responded 6 minutes later. "Rodney, I appreciate your update. I must tell you that the 1 o'clock meeting is for government only. The only non-government allowed are contractors under contract directly supporting the government. Am I to understand that you will be briefing prior to the meeting? Please do know there has been a misunderstanding." She copied the email to a number of others, among them the deputy who had authorized Rodney's attendance. Rodney wrote back that there had been no misunderstanding, that he had been asked to brief people at the meeting at 1 o'clock. He was also, in fact, a contractor directly supporting the government, but he did not wish to split hairs. "Let me know if I should cancel coming over," he wrote. Moments later, an email flashed on Rodney's screen from the deputy who had approved the session, mailed to him and a large number of others, including Kwan. It read simply, "He can brief at the meeting." Rodney was startled. After all, this was supposed to be Kwan's deputy. He surmised that the Commerce Department official who had spoken to the deputy earlier must have complained about hearing of the new Conficker variant from Rodney, a civilian, a naturalized citizen with a foreign accent to boot, instead of from the agency charged with responsibility for such things. Rodney could imagine how that conversation must have gone.
"You mean to tell me you jackasses have no bloody idea this is happening?"
He sensed serious trouble in Kwan's kingdom. Indeed, she would resign 5 months later. He sent her another message. "Hey, I really don't want to cause problems for you. Really, I apologize if I did. I wanted to give you a heads up. You don't want me to come? Let me know." Kwan fell silent. She did not respond, nor did she attend the 1 o'clock meeting. Rodney walked into an enormous conference room at FBI headquarters and was led to a lectern. He faced scores of officials, none of whom he recognized except for the attorney reviewing these matters for Obama, who had been at the morning briefing at Commerce. All wore security lanyards with their plastic ID prominently displayed, a totem in Washington's security-obsessed culture, demarcating privileged access and high security clearances. But there were no names on the dangling plastic. He saw every agency acronym he had heard of: FBI, SS, DOD, FAA, FCC, DOJ, NSA, CIA, and many he had not. Curiously, no one in the room introduced him or herself. Just as with the cabal's dealings with the feds throughout, for these people, information flowed in only one direction. They get your name, you don't get theirs. Rodney had brought along a USB thumb drive with his presentation and a laptop of his own because he knew the government had banned the use of thumb drives the previous year, a rule dating back to the fiasco of the thumb drives in the Pentagon parking lot. But instead, one of the men took the drive and plugged it right into a laptop at the lectern. Rodney laughed.
"What?" asked the man.
"I'll get to it," said Rodney. He gave a condensed version of the presentation he had given that morning. He saw the officials in the room exchanging startled looks and shrugs with each other. "Did you know about this? I haven't heard a thing." He told them how the botmaster had been upping his game, outmaneuvering the cabal for months. He did his best, as Rick had done almost 2 months earlier, to describe the scope of the threat. He mentioned the thumb drive issue, an infection vector ever since Conficker B, and explained his earlier laughter, his astonishment that DHS itself had evidently ignored the widely touted ban. He had been allotted 15 minutes for his talk, and an hour later, he was still at the lectern answering questions, explaining. The concern and surprise of the officials were evident. Rodney did his best not to throw U.S. cert under the bus, but he could see why Kwan had tried to head off this briefing and then had skipped it. It was embarrassing. A small group followed him out of the room when he was finished. Rodney asked them who they were.
"I'm from the FAA," said one.
"I hope I wasn't boring you," said Rodney.
"No, I'm on my way back to Kansas City. We have an issue."
When he got back to New Star, there were messages from several congressional offices asking that he come to the Hill to brief this or that senator or representative. He went right out and bought another white shirt, because clearly he was going to have a few more reasons to dress up this week. In the congressional office building the next day, between meetings, he received a message from one of the attendees of the Monday afternoon briefing, double-checking some of the details in the PowerPoint presentation. Rodney just emailed it to him from his thumb drive. One of his assistants came to him later that day and told him he had received a phone call from a contact at U.S. CERT asking questions about Conficker. It seems the agency had been tasked to make a presentation on the worm at the White House that day. The assistant had referred him to Rodney, and the contact had responded, "We're not allowed to talk to him." So Kwan had apparently taken umbrage at Rodney's big show, but he clearly now had the Fed's attention. "People seem to finally be getting that this is not a joke," Rodney told his assistant. The following day he was asked to brief the staff of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. Because the committee's offices were off-limits to those without a high security clearance, the staff arranged to meet with Rodney in the visitor's center of the Capitol building in the cafeteria. About a dozen staffers met him there in the middle of the afternoon. The cafeteria was quiet and mostly empty. They cordoned off a portion of the big room with portable dividers and sat around a long table. Before Rodney got started, one of the staffers, a young woman, interrupted him. "Just so you know," she said, "we probably know a whole lot more about Conficker than you do. We received a classified briefing yesterday afternoon," the woman said. "So there's probably not much more you can tell us about this."
"That's really good news," said Rodney, his voice heavy with sarcasm.
By now he knew without a doubt how clueless the establishment was. The woman's arrogance annoyed him. He started collecting his notes.
"Since you have matters completely under control," he said, "then there's no reason for me to be wasting any more of your time."
As he stood, there was a chorus of no's.
"Stay," protested one of the staffers. "We want to hear it," said another.
So Rodney sat back down. He took out copies of his PowerPoint presentation, which had been printed up on New Star stationery. He handed them out around the table. The woman who had addressed him flipped through her copy and pronounced, "Yep, this is the same presentation we saw at the classified White House briefing yesterday." The meeting dissolved into laughter when the staffers realized that U.S. CERT had simply taken Rodney's briefing and presented it at the White House as their own work, and classified it to boot. Rodney later confirmed it with his White House contact, who had attended all three of the sessions. "They just gave yours as their own," the contact said. So much for vaunted federal cyber defenses. This was hard work, this laboring to rouse the great slumbering giant of the U.S. government, trying to enlist its vast resources in the fight. He had been successful to a point. That Thursday, TJ passed along a request to add 8 U.S. CERT officials to the list. So Rodney was stung, after this week-long uphill slog, to find himself being sniped at by some in his own ranks. No one from the cabal itself, at least not directly, but word of Rodney's briefings in Washington had spread far and wide in the geek tribe, as the administrators and staffers at his briefings reached out to their own trusted sources, to their own security experts, asking, "Who is this guy? Are these things he's telling us true? Is this Conficker worm as dangerous as he says it is? If so, why haven't we heard about this from you?" And at least some received answers, no doubt in some cases covering their own ass, that this Rodney Joffe fellow may have exaggerated the danger. After all, the worm had done nothing yet. Some were far enough out of the loop that they still clung to the grad student stunt theory, a la the Morris worm, which had gone out the window with Conficker B. No one who really knew the worm was making this claim, but people on the fringes, people worried that Crying Wolf in Washington might give the tribe itself a bad name, feared that their own credibility might suffer by professional association. There were suggestions that Rodney, beating his drum so loudly, might have been puffing himself up. This was, there is no other word for it, insulting. Rodney was a bona fide internet pioneer. He had practically invented the techniques of e-marketing and e-commerce, and had gone on to invent the content distribution and load balancing technology that was utilized by ISPs all over the world. He wasn't some ivory tower visionary either. He was a successful businessman. With regard to divining where this marvelous technology was going and assessing its strengths and its weaknesses, there were few people in the world who could match his record, who saw the whole thing so clearly. Who better to sound the alarm? Who better to quantify the risk? Very early on Saturday morning, still in Washington, Rodney responded passionately and at length to his critics, posting a letter to everyone on the list. It was a forceful broadside, an argument for the importance of the effort, a defense of his own efforts in Washington, a challenge, and a rallying cry. If they were going to beat this thing, they had to stop undercutting themselves. It led to a remarkable exchange. "Gentlemen, Based on some offline discussion and comments, as well as the reported discomfort of some of you on the list with my activities this week, I'd like to confront the elephant in the room. The problem with Conficker is not Conficker. Since the beginning of the Cabal, we have all been focused on the tactical issues of responding to it, each of us in our way and based on our own agendas. MS, Microsoft, because the initial hole was in the OS, operating system, as well as the fact that ongoing infections and spread occurs with Windows users. Symantec and Kaspersky, because the worm is a bastard to deal with and they make software that has to deal with it. Me and the other registry operators because it uses our resources for CNC, command and control. Registrars because CNC domains get registered through them. ISPs because they provide the transport and their customers are affected. Researchers because they see it and analyze it. Some of us, you, play multiple roles. But none of us has really dealt with why this is bad stuff. Conficker has been relatively harmless so far as we know. And as I was asked and admitted repeatedly as I rang the bells in Washington, we have no evidence that it has been or will be used maliciously. Some on this list have posited that it may just be an experiment that was wildly successful, or perhaps a group of coders proving they can write good code. I was a reserve police officer in Los Angeles for 20 years. I learned that there is real crime in the world, and that some people are just plain evil. Well, I knew that from before, but only through the lessons of history. Working the streets of L.A. gave me firsthand experience at how common it was. Working a homicide scene shows you how even two-bit gangbangers can be truly evil given half a chance. So I say, bullshit. This isn't a game. Looking at this list, every one of you has been the victim of a 6-20-11 DDoS. You've all dealt with spam. I know that most of you have been pwned and had your keystrokes logged or traffic sniffed by malware. And at least one of you has been on the receiving end of extortion. So you know better. You know what a botnet can do, a small one. We all know that a botnet of Conficker's size is an effing lethal weapon in the wrong hands. Well, who do you think the wrong hands are? I have been accused of spreading FUD in Washington, of making a bigger thing of this than it is. So I want a discussion here and now to deal with this once and for all, otherwise, pfft to you. You're taking your employer's money or the taxpayer's money under false pretenses. This is also not about PR. I have not had a single conversation that wasn't covered by some sort of requirement of confidentiality. The only conversations I have had are with one of you or a government official who serves in some or other form as a specialist in security or a legislator or staffer with TS, top security, clearance, or better on a committee that has cybersecurity under its purview. And I have not shared a single piece of information without first asking the source or author of that piece of information for permission, period. I have refused to allow any of our Newstar's employees to even take a call from the press, and I have no intention of doing so until this group reaches consensus that we need to. Now back to the discussion. Conficker hasn't caused any damage. It doesn't slow its hosts down. It hasn't eaten bandwidth. And it certainly hasn't caused me any load problems. But what if it does? What happens to the net in general if each of the infected hosts sends just one other infected host 20 kilobytes per second of traffic a second all at the same time? Or makes just one 50 kilobyte web post every few seconds to a mixture of Yahoo, CNN, Google, Hotmail, and other well-connected sites? Given the nice maps you have, most of the world's networks will collapse. Some of them just because they're in the path. I don't care who you are. Certainly all of the Tier 2 networks would fall over. What would that do to the world? Not the Internet, the modern connected world. How many infected hosts are there inside the Fortune 500? So what would it mean for the economy if the Fortune 500 all had their internal networks shut down for an hour? A day,
A week. Now let me ask you this. If you were the bot master and had a botnet of 2 million machines, how difficult would it be for you to bring the net worldwide to a halt?
Ah, you are really clueful. The best in the world at your job, but you're a good guy. And you wouldn't do that kind of thing, so who the hell do you think they are? Are all the miscreants stupid? Do you think they're all capitalists who need the net to be up so they can continue to siphon passwords and read email and surf porn? And if you're so damn bright, why haven't you already managed to shut A/B down, or C, or Wolodak, or Torpig? Could it be because those bastards on the other side are as smart as you are, or smarter? As we sit here now, they've managed to update 1 million of the A/B suckers, and you still don't know how they're doing it, right in front of you. It took you apparently 2 days to even notice, and a week later you're still sucking wind, and you're the best we have. What happens if one of them wakes up in a bad mood tomorrow morning, or after a night of drinking or dope or being beaten in some humongous online game decides that the rest of the world is filled with evil by their way of thinking and needs to be destroyed, just like in the game? So as I said in my first heated briefing on Monday, this isn't about Configure A, B, or C, or Storm, or Slammer, or Torpig. It's about all of them. Those in the past and those in the future. It's about the one evil bastard who decides that he is going to use his botnet, or a piece of it, to punish someone else. It's about the fact that the ability to use it maliciously exists, and we have stood by and let it happen, and we haven't marshaled all of our resources to try and deal with it. The people I talk to in Washington who make the laws and rules and run our lives, and who we elected and who swear to serve us, we the people, have no fucking clue that this is out there. Now a few of them do, in terms that they understand. We need them to understand because we need them to give us help and resources. Except that some of you, or your employers, are telling them that it's not that dire, or as bad as I say it is. Tell me we're not one command away from a catastrophe. I dare you. A few hours later, out in San Francisco, the ever-doer Paul Vixie took up the challenge, beginning with an answer to Rodney's dare and proceeding to a broad, measured reflection on the fragility of our emerging digital world. I won't, but I will provide some personal context, much of which is probably shared by others in this community. These problems have been here so long that the only way I've been able to function at all is by learning to ignore them. Else I would be in a constant state of panic, unable to think or act constructively. We have been one command away from catastrophe for a long time now, in 1,000 small ways that I'm aware of and an expected 1 million other ways I'm not aware of. The world has gotten dangerous and fragile and interdependent. And that's without us even talking about power grids or the food stocks available in high population areas if rail and truck stops working for a week. And in 100 large ways that I'm aware of and an expected 1,000 I don't know of, ethically incompatible people out in the world have acquired and will acquire assets that are lethal to the industrial world's way of life. Criminals and terrorists using the Internet for asymmetric warfare is the great fear of our age, or at least it's my great fear. But I've lived with it so long that I have lost the ability to panic about it. One day at a time, I do what I can. I do not want this to be interpreted by anyone as me disagreeing with R. Joffe's basic observations and predictions. I'm saying the problem is far worse than he made it out to be, because I am not the only one who has had to learn how to tune out the constant state of danger and get on with my life. All of us have. A full accounting of the problems we are collectively, deliberately not thinking about in order to stay sane would be quite a shock to any of us who saw it. Now, if people in D.C. have been telling other people in D.C. that there's no emergency here in Internet land, and that they've got it all under control, then they are certainly wrong. But as to whether they're ignorant and confused, or self-serving liars, I could not say from what little I know. But if people in D.C. are telling other people in D.C. that this is not the same threat level as 9/11, then they've probably got a point. Tomorrow the Internet may die for several days, if some bot herder gets jilted by a boyfriend or whatever. There would be loss of life and a whole lot of money as a result. But there'd be no way to politicize it the way that 9/11 was politicized, because not all the fire trucks and ambulances would be in the same place or shown on the same nightly news program. So from a D.C. denizen's point of view, the Internet's not in trouble, by the odd definition of trouble that most D.C. denizens have to use, and we all ought to be worried about a world that's as broken as all that. I don't advocate that we learn to live with this new class of threat, but I also don't know what choices we have. In a free world, it will be possible for this kind of thing to happen. We need more vigilance and more objective measurements. We need to change some fundamentals so that LE, law enforcement, can track these guys down in any country they operate from and kick in their doors and haul them away in chains and haul their computers away in trucks. We need a lot of help from government, and we cannot be telling people in government that we've got it under control because we absolutely do not have it under control. At best, we have it under light surveillance in between the times one of us goes out on a donut break. It was a dark vision of where things were heading, but a legitimate one. C-Day was just 8 days away. 10. Cyber Armageddon. And is it any less mad to believe a handful of mutants might save the entire world? The Amazing X-Men. John Crane had been minding his own business, literally, that evening at the Holiday Inn in Atlanta in early February at the Georgia Tech DNS Symposium when his boss volunteered him to save the Internet from Conficker. His official title at ICANN was so complex that he would just tell people, "It's very long and it has something to do with security," and then hand them his card. Since the Georgia Tech conference had been convened to compare notes and discuss all the ways the Internet was at risk, it made sense for him to attend. Security issues had not been paramount when ICANN was established in 1998, taking over the role of assigning and keeping track of domain names and numbers worldwide. But as the malware problem grew in intensity and sophistication, its position as the only international body with any slight authority over the Internet had turned John's security job into a pivotal one. The Georgia Tech Conference was an effort to draw together the disparate players concerned about the threat, and John had helped set it up. He had been roped into attending the cabal's rump session that night by ICANN's president, Paul Toomey. And when his boss turned to him to be ICANN's point man with the cabal, John said the only thing a man who loves his job can say in such circumstances. "Yes, sir. Now, what exactly are we talking about here?" The specific task that night was to get China on board, since the newly released B strain included that country's TLD.CN, and because most of the infected computers were there, and because nobody else in the room had a clue as to how to go about enlisting the help of the Middle Kingdom, Rick Wesson having not yet informed the group about his own outreach to China. Perhaps because of Rick's unauthorized outreach, the task happily proved to be a lot easier than anyone, including John, imagined. A few phone calls and a couple of emails. Still, John had earned a reputation for working wonders, so when Conficker C upped the ante from 250 to 50,000 domains and the list of 8 targeted TLDs to 116, all eyes again turned his way. He made a terrific ambassador, easy to talk to, fun, the kind of guy who loves to sip good whiskey and talk music. John projects no hint of his profound, really one-of-a-kind, level of international expertise. The Internet is so new that even those capable of doing John's job could not have accumulated his contacts and experience.
He has a broad face with a small pinched mouth and prominent dark arching eyebrows, with straight dark hair that forms a striking widow's peak. He combs it straight back, in a style that, with the eyebrows, can give him a slightly diabolical look, which is misleading, because he is both cheerful and unfailingly straightforward. He had somehow contracted a passion while growing up in the East Midlands of England, in Leicester, for 1950s-era American country and rockabilly music. Long before he even contemplated moving to the United States, he had begun affecting cowboy boots and shirts. His friends called him Tex. At about the same time, he had begun working with computers, playing video games like Star Trek with his brother and father, and tapping into the mainframe of British Gas, where his father worked. In the 3 decades since, he was now 43, he had earned a degree in mechanical engineering and had set to work on computer networks when the Internet was still in its infancy. Dressed now in somewhat fancier cowboy boots and shirts, John has become the globe-trotting, something-to-do-with-security man for ICANN, working when he is not on the road from an alcove in a spare bedroom of his suburban home in Long Beach, California, where he settled in search of perfect weather. I was working with this American fellow in Amsterdam, and it was raining, and he said, "Why don't you come to California? It's not raining there." When Conficker C arrived, John had 3 weeks to enlist the help of nearly a third of the TLDs in the world, including every top-level country code. If a nation had its own TLD, John had to recruit it to play ball with the cabal. This meant asking the domain name server, DNS, in countries on every continent. Well, the pitch might have gone something like this. "Kind sir, with apologies, would you mind terribly setting aside this long list of domains? Since the servers made money for every domain name they sold, this was asking them to essentially give away hundreds, or perhaps eventually thousands, of revenue-generating items. And would you also set up a system to intercept inquiries sent to these domain names by this nasty botnet Conficker beginning on April 1st and redirect them all to a sinkhole operated by this grad student named Chris Lee at an American university in Atlanta, Georgia, called Georgia Tech? You know, the Ramblin' Wreck. Everybody over here has heard of it. Really? In doing so, kind sir, you will be performing a heroic service to the health of the Internet, and, need I mention, for the reputation of your registry and country. Just think how bad you are going to look if you don't play along. And, forget about getting any credit for your generosity here, would you mind keeping this all secret? We'll supply you with the lists, trust us, and, oh yes, if any of those randomly generated domains happens to be owned already, for every collision, we'll be needing you to authenticate its ownership and then contact the poor sap and work out arrangements to shut him down, but only for a few days, in order to protect him from being swamped by the evil botmaster. And, did I forget to mention, just one more little thing, would you please do this every day for ever? From now until the end of time?" Okay, it sure didn't sound like an easy sell. Some members of the cabal had concerns about even making the pitch. What if this country-by-country effort succeeded, and then resulted in breaking a law somewhere, or prompted some TLD acting at the cabal's behest to anger one of the website owners whose domain collided with Conficker's daily list? "I do not have to want to avoid travel to certain parts of the world because XX years ago I tried to help the Internet and someone felt I violated some privacy law and filed a suit which resulted in a warrant for my arrest in YY country," wrote Dre Ludwig. The botmaster was, of course, counting on this being an impossible sell, and John had little quarrel with that logic. He expected to fail. It was his job, but, are you serious? Really? Remember, ICANN has no authority whatsoever. There are no little black helicopters to swoop in and enforce the global will. There is no applicable international law. And who could even characterize this as the global will? This was coming from an ad hoc group of volunteers, the X-Men, with no official role even in the United States, much less in the world community. Chris Lee was still in grad school, for Christ's sake. He did, however, already have a PhD. Few of the people running these things, in Africa, in South America, in Asia, had ever heard of Conficker, much less of the Cabal. ICANN had no leverage beyond an appeal to international fellowship and John Crane's charm. And yet, wasn't it in everyone's interest to keep the Internet functioning smoothly? The global network rested upon a common commitment to good sense and goodwill, didn't it? Some of the TLDs involved began asking why Microsoft wasn't just buying up all of the Conficker-generated domains itself. After all, it was Microsoft's leaky software that allowed the worm to flourish, and everybody had been reading for years about Bill Gates's countless billions. This touched upon widespread resentment of the giant software company for owning such a huge share of the market worldwide, and, in some cases, for corporate practices considered predatory. Some of this discussion found its way to the list, where TJ remained conspicuously silent on the subject. When one of the TLD operators complained that Microsoft should have to pay for cleaning up its own mess, Paul Vixie responded with frustration, "Then perhaps you should organize a class action lawsuit, but it's not in scope for the public health crisis to wonder what company profited from creating the fragile conditions, or else the board and CEO of McDonald's would be in prison for the world's diabetes problems. We really digress." Even Paul, who shared this view of Microsoft's responsibility, could see the folly of assigning blame while the Internet was on fire. The Cabal set upon working out various technological solutions, some way of automating the process of blacklisting or blocking the never-ending list of potential command locations. How better to fight a computer than with a computer? But the problem was less technical than political. In order to put an automated process to work, they would still need the full cooperation of every one of those TLDs. The biggest problem was collisions. In these cases, the owners of the sites had to be checked out and enlisted in the effort, and if even one balked, if even one was owned by or paid off by the botmaster, the whole effort could fail. The authors of the worm had already managed to upgrade it twice, by registering several domains right under their noses. John began shipping off the ask in mid-March. In those cases where there were collisions, Chris Lee would contact the unlucky website operator directly with the request to block traffic on the given date and instructions on how to direct it to his sinkhole. Needless to say, this was a strange note to get. Unprecedented. Some noodle you never heard of in Atlanta, Georgia, USA, writes to you out of the blue and asks you, for the good of humanity, to shut down your business for a day and reroute all your web traffic to him. One contractor who managed a website that collided with the worm's list happened to be a Georgia Tech grad himself, so he wrote back to Chris, "I believe that this email is not from you, nor is it in your general character to send out such an email. But if somebody is sending out this email with the from address spoofed to your name, thought you might like to know. Also, perhaps, you can help me solve the riddle of what the real intent or endgame of this email is. Technically speaking, it is clear that this is a hoax. I cannot imagine you sitting at home psycho-obsessively finding slash predicting secret lists of likely Conficker victim domains, researching all their whois records, and writing to every one of these 500 people in need of your rescue per day. This was, of course, very nearly what the Cabal was doing, except that relatively few of the domain names generated by the worm actually belonged to anyone. Chris forwarded the note to Rodney, who promptly boomed a warning shot across the contractor's bow that opened with a weighty recitation of his credentials, Senior Vice President and Senior Technologist of Neustar, member of the ICANN Security and Stability Advisory Committee, and then explained that, improbable as it might seem, the Conficker binary does, as Dr. Lee noted, generate 500 random domain names each day that it then uses to contact the Conficker CNC, Command and Control. The algorithm has been decoded, and so we know in advance what domain names will be used by the CNC and bots every day from now on, subject to the malware being updated. Rodney continued,
Dr. Lee and others in this core group have compared the domain names that are due to be used by the CNC with domains that are already registered. Obviously, the randomness of the malware algorithm results in some collisions with domains that have already been registered. Your client's domain name is one of those very few. The unregistered domains have been dealt with. But the concerns are for those few domains like your client's that will now receive millions of connections from compromised configure systems on their magical day. In your client's case, March 18th. And in order for the configure authors to successfully operate, their best bet is to compromise the machines behind your client's domain name by March 18th. Hence, Dr. Lee's concern and his email to you. Please be assured, unfortunately, that the people behind Configure are highly sophisticated in their ability to compromise web servers, even those that are especially hardened. So I would urge you to heed Dr. Lee's offer of help. Despite what you may believe based on looking at his public pages at GT, Georgia Tech, he is an expert in this field and one of our best. That got the bastard in line. Stefan Bortsmeyer, who worked for the Association Française pour la Nommage Internet and Coopération, AFNIC, a targeted French registry, was irritated by John's request. I am a simple employee and have zero authority to decide what AFNIC will or will not do. The letter reads as if the decision has already been taken. It even seems to contain threats to non-compliers. Same thing when you ask people not to discuss the actions to take, but to simply report what stage they are in the implementation of an already decided plan. I suggest that we first discuss the solution. Is blocking thousands of domains a scalable solution when Configure can always extend its list? It does not seem that there is, for Configure C, a published implementation of the algorithm. Therefore, we have to blindly trust the list of domain names. That's annoying. John wrote back to apologize for any confusion and pointed out that the letter he had sent was, in fact, just a request. Rick Wesson also responded, "Please understand that there is some urgency and the task to even attempt a global response coordination within 18 days is difficult. As far as decision-making, each TLD has made their own decision. The effort only works if we all decide it is in the global interest to participate. This is the decision most organizations are taking." Rick sent him the link and a password to the list so he could verify the nature of the effort for himself. Stefan came on board, but only after asking for and receiving a cover-your-ass document with a certified signature, which was a little strange, there being no real authority in a position to give an order or make a demand. The strain of getting this done with the clock ticking relentlessly showed within the cabal. The list, previously calm and professional in tone for the most part, usually deep into the technical issues of sinkholing and tracking a multi-million node botnet, but also eloquent on occasion, degenerated in some predictable quarters and also in some less predictable ones. The sheer volume of data being accumulated by all the domains Configure C was programmed to generate required that the sinkholing operation be expanded. This was just one of the complications the botmaster apparently hoped would unravel the cabal. It did not, but it definitely added stress. Rick kicked up a row inadvertently when he breezily volunteered his company to do some of the work. "I expect to play a role with sinkholing C just 'cause I got a /16, a very large internet interface, to play with, and it sounds fun." His tone rubbed Paul Vixie the wrong way. "That's not a good reason, especially for a key man who was already carrying a large coordination burden for the overall project. I am aggravated by your use of the words play and fun. This is a deeply serious activity on which we have collectively and individually screwed every possible pooch there was to screw in the A/B effort. Configure A and B." Rick wasn't giving up. "It's all in how you look at your job. I heard a one-star general refer to tanks as toys and Browning M2s as pop guns. I guess it comes from scale and your individual reference. I still enjoy my job,
emoticon smiley face. So, yes, even really serious stuff to you still seems like fun and a good time to me. I'd rather have an interesting day job than, well, deal with drama like this. He went on to complain about various technical issues relating to the sharing of sinkholed data, and suggested that Paul was being held to a different, less stringent standard. Paul wrote back to defend himself, telling Rick to stop comparing their operations, and reminding him that while he, Paul, had never accused Rick of sharing data inappropriately, he still wasn't ruling out the possibility that he had, and had lied about it. If you've been sharing data with people who the rest of us don't know about, then that's a problem, and if you haven't, then it's not a problem. Rick responded, I hated high school for the same reasons this thread exists. If there is anything that makes me never want to do this again, it's working on projects until they digress into he said, she said. It's happened more than once with you, Paul. I'll not be participating in this thread any longer. If you have an issue you need to discuss with me, pick up the phone. The matter would have ended there, except that Rick's accusation that Paul had also allowed unauthorized access to sinkholed Conficker data inadvertently implicated another key member of the cabal, Chris Lee, who was now managing the bulk of the sinkhole operation. Ordinarily a very mild, detail-oriented, unemotional technician, Chris finally unloaded on the most feisty and, some felt, fishy member of the group, bringing up his still simmering indignation over Rick's rogue approach to China. When I operate the sinkhole, I wear my GT Georgia Tech hat. In this case, there existed a clandestine exfiltration of that data to another country, one that is well known to leverage cyber capabilities, which created a direct conflict of interest with my activities and my employer. You knew this and did not tell me or anyone else. I collected data in a very open fashion, and with the impression that the data was only being shared within the cabal. When I addressed my concern to you, you treated me as if I were trying to undermine the entire effort and gave veiled threats. There were plenty of opportunities for you to clearly state your motives to me and work out a nice compromise, but that's not the route you chose at the time. Now, I cannot trust you. This undermines our entire effort. You don't trust me, and everything I do or say, or even silence, you view as an attack or a game. This will not work. We either work out our differences, or at least one of us will have to leave. I hope that I'm humble enough to continue to listen, understand, and find good solutions, but that window is closing fast as I am starting to feel attacked and am losing my objectivity. Your other activities of talking with various government organizations, NYT, the New York Times, and to the CCTLD without coordination and oversight also expands my suspicion of your activities. You seem to want to avoid any checks on your actions and try to hide what you're doing. This cannot scale. We are a team. We have the same goals, roughly. We can work this out. I have been silent recently in hopes that my objections would not stand in the way of all of us working together and to avoid everything I say from sounding like an attack or being attacked by someone who is suspicious of me. We are at the cusp of doing great things together. Let's stop the games, as Joffe has yelled clearly in email, and work together. I am not attacking you, and I do not think you are evil. We do have a difference in approach and opinion, one that could easily be solved. I think you are avoiding oversight because you think some of us will be hostile toward you and attack. This is likely not the case. Hiding what you do will cause animosity. We were friends once, Rick. I want to be friends again. The three eventually retreated to hammering out their differences on the telephone, but not until after Rick once more posted a reference to their contretemps as a high school drama. Chris complained about the analogy, prompting Dre Ludwig to weigh in and address Rick directly. It is my humble estimation that you are out of line with not only your response, but multiple actions you have taken over the last month and a half. I agree with all of Chris's previous points, and there are serious trust issues that you have caused yourself.
I think every individual who is a part of this effort has a legitimate right to ask questions of you based on what you have already told this group. You may not understand it, but the circles you are trying to swim in are rather small, but very deep. Any ripple that is made has a tendency to reflect off of multiple individuals in this group. Dre complained that Rick had still never supplied a list of everyone with whom he had shared the sinkhole data. Let me also restate one thing. Rick, this is not a personal attack. If it was such, there would be no room for misinterpretation on my part. We need cold hard facts, not personal attacks, misdirection, or lack of results. I had asked for this on previous phone calls, and I have yet to see anything come of it. So please, let us avoid the high school drama, as you put it, and deal with cold hard data. Their dispute then vanished from the list as they worked the dispute out on the phone, but animosity and suspicion remained. On March 24th, just a week before C-Day, Rick posted an angry note to Paul, who had complained that the effort was flagging and that some sinkhole operators might need to be replaced. I am growing tired of you stating that it is not working. It is, but you are just unsatisfied in how it is working. Be clear, post some statistics, or shut up. You don't get to remove any A/B, configure A and B, sinkhole operators, but I can remove you, so pipe down. Paul responded. Finally, T.J. Campana, up in his office in the Redmond Sprocket, had had enough. He wrote, "Stop. What hurts the efforts the most is the bullshit that is being tossed around here. Either we learn to play nice or we, meaning I, will make arrangements for both of you to go home. We need to do better, but this will not happen overnight. For some of us, this is our first stab at sinkholing a threat, and we are having some growing pains." Rodney wasn't far behind, once more stepping up as the adult in the room. "Cut the bullshit infighting out. Don't you realize that from the outside, and maybe in reality, the cohesive group that has worked so well to get this far is about to fall apart? None of you will win. The only winners will be the people we're fighting to defeat. I guarantee that if we don't get our shit together, the next NYT, New York Times, or WP, Washington Post headline will be, 'Configure Cabal Collapses,' and I don't want to be part of that. So please recognize that every time one of you pisses on another's shoes, hundreds of people are seeing it one way or the other. When I organized the group meeting in Atlanta, my objective was to help find a solution to one part of the problem, with the hope that it would help to find a way to survive against the bad guys. That is still my prime objective. Unlike some of you, I don't have a business model that is part of the Configure battle. I don't sell software that deals with Configure. I don't sell services that deal with Configure. I don't sell hardware that deals with Configure. I don't have a consulting business that deals with Configure. I am just an internet user with a little bit of history and a few thousand customers, and I want the internet to survive. If there are any of you on this list that feel differently, then say so, and let those of us with a different primary objective go somewhere else to continue the fight. Otherwise, please get together and make some decisions that work for all of us, and